Hi there, and welcome back to another edition of Built to Sell Radio, the podcast designed to help you punch above your weight in a negotiation to sell your company. I'm the executive producer, Colin Morgan, and today on the show, we're joined by Ned McPherson. Ned started helping clients optimize their website back in 2016. Demand for Ned's time quickly outpaced supply, so he started building a team. Within 7 years, he had 70 employees, more than $2 million a year in EBITDA, and multiple acquisition offers. Just a quick thank you before we begin. Today's guest was a nomination from Todd Taske, an M&A professional who has had a lot of experience selling marketing service businesses. If you'd like to nominate a guest like Todd, visit builttosell.com/nominate. Without further ado, here is Ned McPherson. Enjoy.
Ned McPherson, welcome to Built to Sell Radio.
Thanks for having me.
How did you get started with NRock? Tell me the founder story here.
Yeah, sure. So NRock by nature was a consumer analytics growth optimization agency, right? So for those not in the e-commerce space, right, that's more affectionately known as conversion rate optimization, average order value optimization. Basically, we're that team that if you had a website, classic e-commerce brand, and you said, you know what, I'm driving traffic to the site, if the ads are performing better and better, our email program's getting better, how do we prove out a better conversion rate on the website? Meaning for every 100 new folks who come to the site, how do I go from, you know, two of them buying to three of them buying, right? Or the average order value of $100 to say $110. Well, the solution to that is through rapid experimentation, right? Running ongoing experiments, A/B tests, multivariate testing, et cetera. So that's by nature what NRock was. And my background's in statistics and frankly, started in the direct-to-consumer e-commerce space by helping brands make sense and rebuild their analytics stacks. When I first kind of got started in the industry in the 2016, 2017 timeframe, I kept finding a lot of brands I was interacting with. Just there was a healthy level of ignorance there as to how to analyze data, how to interpret data. Classic example, mistakes they were making, type one, type two errors, mistaking correlation and causation, misunderstanding false negatives and false positives, et cetera. So for the very few who even were trying to infer insight from their data, they were kind of veering in these bizarre directions. So I was like, you know what, let me try to clean this up for them, try to make more sense of it. And then together, maybe I could help them launch on a more data-driven program, if you will, to make sense of their business and drive change, right? And try to scale. That quickly turned into me providing ideation based on what I found in the data, to which I would give these ideas to the businesses and they'd always get really excited about it. But I'd always find not one of them ever executed on a single idea I gave them. So after a while, eventually I was like, okay, the writing is on the wall here. There's an execution model to be had as well. So that's when I kind of pivoted the brand and came into this world of, let me analyze your data. Let me find some really interesting hypotheses to test against, and then let me build experiments for you, right? That was the winning ticket there in terms of the go-to-market message structure, the market fit structure, if you will. And we started to scale really quickly. At first, me just as a solo freelancer contractor, if you will, and then the demand was enough that in the beginning of 2019, I started to build a team and we scaled it pretty quickly and aggressively from there. But yeah, that was how it started, right? It was starting with data modeling and then just kind of fell into the world of experimentation.
I want to talk about the pivot from, you know, propeller head guru guy to building a team. Before I go there though, you said something that I didn't know the answer to. So I've heard causation correlation. I understand the difference between the two of those. I do not understand type one versus type two. What is that?
Yeah, right. I mean, these are classic mistakes that are made in honestly analysis, right? I mean, this is stuff that you would learn when you start getting into kind of like stats 101 specifically, where you start trying to understand what data is saying back to you and understanding, again, like, is there a causal factor that is translating into a underperformance or an overperformance or what have you. And when you start to mistake causality, right, as an example, this is where you start to get into the world of type one versus type two errors, right?
I see. So they're related.
Yeah. So it's classic stuff. I mean, you know, examples of getting into deeper like causality issues, right, is where, here's a classic example, is you'll take a brand that maybe the conversion rate's struggling and a lot of people will disproportionately look at the website from the initial user experience. So they'll go and they'll look at like the homepage and they'll say, you know what? Let's change the hero banner. Let's make it edgier. Let's be more hip. Let's try to change this or that or get more aggressive with our message structure. And almost always they'll find disappointment in that route. And it's not necessarily because that new design wasn't better or that new message structure wasn't more engaging. It's more often because that wasn't the leak in the bucket. As an example, it's like you're looking at this home that you want to renovate and you're ideating on repainting the shutters, but there's holes in the roof. So identifying where the real, we call metrics on fire are, is the nature of where you need to focus. And that's what I mean by getting into like causality, because when you start to figure out where there's really weak points in a funnel or in consumer interaction, that is the tea leaf, so to speak, that says this is the direction of where we need to solve. And frankly, my model's basically just been running experimentation around those metrics. We very rarely get it right on the first go. But the point is, and I guess the reason why we've had disproportionate success over the years isn't necessarily because the ideas are better than anyone else. It's just we know where to focus those ideas. And then we stay persistent. And then you start to see some of those lifts.
Okay, so tell me about the decision to build a team, because there's a lot of conversion rate gurus, I'll call them, or you know, data scientists who have no interest in building a team. They want to be a freelancer. They love coming in and being the smartest guy in the room, but then like they don't want to do anything to do with managing employees or executing. But you made a different decision. Walk me through your thinking. Why not stay as an independent consultant?
Yeah. I did for about a year and a half, almost 2 years. And it was great. Honestly, great classic little lifestyle business, right? I mean, very low cost. I mean, very high margin. Obviously, it was really just my time and such. And had some excellent clients. I think I had 5 clients is where I maxed out to. And it was great. It was just mainly meeting the demand, right? And I'm kind of an entrepreneur at heart. I had started a couple other gigs before I had started Endrock. And, you know, where there's demand, there's an opportunity to scale. And my absolute favorite line in business is build what you can sell. And so most people go about it the other way. A classic example of this is like tech, right? I mean, look at the graveyard of applications, consumer facing and mobile applications, web applications, SaaS models, different softwares, because they were all driven by these teams who were phenomenal at building things, but they built something, unfortunately, no one really cared about, right? And that sounds a little brutal to say, but to me, that was kind of my obsession for years there is build what you can sell and figure out what the market wants to pay for. And I kept iterating the model, frankly. I even called myself an outsourced CMO. I called myself an outsourced CRO. I started doing all these different things. And people kept coming back to calling me like the experiment guy, the analytics guy. So like the points were there that kept pointing me back to say, this is what the market wants you to do, right? And so as I proved that out, saw the demand, and more people said, hey, we need more tests. We need faster. We can't get your time because you're already booked up with these other clients. It became obvious that I could scale the business, right? As opposed to many companies will hire and build this infrastructure only to go out to the marketplace to realize that if the demand's not there, right? And then they really struggle oftentimes to get into profitability. And I'm happy to say we were very profitable throughout the entire tenure of the company.
Amazing. So I want to talk about how you recruited talent, because in the early days in this kind of venture, it's just you, but you've made the decision given the demand to grow. Did you bring on partners or were these like employees? How did you structure it? You know, commercially.
Yeah. I mean, without getting too much into the personal, but I had started a few other businesses prior to that. And I'm a classic hard-headed entrepreneur, right? You know, I mean, very stubborn in my opinion, oftentimes very pragmatic thinking, very data-driven. And I had some good partnerships, but I could never get these companies to take off, right? I mean, I'd started a handful of them before and we did okay. Like we could support ourselves, but I mean, nothing, put it this way, nothing to warrant being on a podcast to discuss, right? And I kind of just, you know, had a revelation and really wanted to go it alone, right? For a while and wanted to just do this on my own. And so as I started to kind of attract in good talent, I was very focused on what can I offer them in terms of a good stable position, a good job, upward projection, good leadership opportunities, et cetera. And I was far less focused on needing a partner. If there was something I didn't know how to do, my model was either hire for it or learn it and don't go give away part of the farm, so to speak, to kind of bring on a partner. I did entertain in the early days, potentially bringing on an investment partner. And that was very short lived, mainly because a client of mine loved the model so much. He had come to me and said, would you ever consider this? And, you know, when you're a young entrepreneur, kind of in your 20s, and someone offers a substantial amount of money to seed the company, you kind of see dollar signs there, but very quickly realize those aren't really dollar signs like an exit. Those are liabilities. You know what I mean? I mean, you have to be a good steward and fiscally responsible to that investment. Not that you wouldn't be fiscally responsible when you're bootstrapping it, but I just didn't need nor want that added stress or pressure of having a finance partner, a financial partner, an investor. So I rejected that offer effectively and then just kept building it on my own, the slow route, the traditional route, right? And
well, not too slow. You got from like zero to 100 employees or 70 employees or whatever it was, like in 4 years.
So, yeah, we did. Yeah.
You know, you weren't plodding along.
Yeah.
But I want to drill in on this a little bit more, because for service companies, you know, to attract talent, they have to give up equity.
Yeah.
So I'll use a law firm as an example, right? So, you know, the Christmas tree sort of architecture is like the partner is the one who does the client work. They're the ones in the interface. But once their time runs out, they've got to basically share equity. In other words, make new partners in order to get the level of talent they need to service the clients in the way they want. And that's the same in advertising agencies and virtually all service businesses. You know, the founder gets diluted down to virtually nothing because they've just had to share equity with everyone in order to grow.
Yeah.
How did you attract the type of talent that you needed without giving up equity?
Yeah, a couple things. One is I built a very substantial workforce nearshore. So I built a lot of my employees out of Latin America. So I used effectively an arbitrage model there, where for you and I, it was very cost effective, the rates being here in the United States. For Ecuador, Colombia, Mexico, these were very aggressive salaries, right? So I was able to attract top talent, and I spent a lot of time in those countries really trying to dig in to understand basically where the best talent was being educated, where it was being fostered, and where I could identify it. And if boy, could I make that recommendation? I don't think I could recommend it enough. There is tremendous talent in Latin America if you know where and how to look for it. As an example, there are some programs in Latin American countries who effectively state, I'm simplifying it, but if you're smart enough and sharp enough as a high school student, the equivalent of, to get admitted into a US university, some of these programs behind some of these governments will underwrite your tuition, so effectively a full scholarship, and your living expenses while you're in the United States, with the understanding that you'll come back and contribute to the local economy. So I was able to identify, I mean, not just one or two, like a few dozen. I mean, Boston University, Northeastern, Penn State, Ohio. I mean, these are, you know, great universities in the United States. However, they're living in Medellin, Colombia. They're living in Quito, Ecuador. They're living in Mexico City, and they effectively command a rate that is commensurate with more locale, not with necessarily even like their peers in here in the United States, despite having the same degree and graduating from the same university. So there was a great way there to kind of arbitrage tremendous talent at an effective enough rate that we were able to keep our margin high enough that I was able to give a lot of raises. I was able to give a lot of bonuses. I was able to build a very strong, aggressive compensation model for people, even for a small company, right? Things that would mirror some of the big companies. At the same token, I was very kind of centric with teams about what the end goal was, right? Which, by the way, was not to exit. The goal was to become the known, the absolute go-to agency for all things. We call it post-click optimization. That's experimentation, A/B testing, multivariate testing, what have you. And then I kind of painted the vision that as we grew, there would be virtually unlimited upward mobility for them, not only on a compensation scale, but also on a leadership scale. So I painted out that, like, you know, right now we called them growth leads. They were our kind of like senior most people. There's a growth lead, then there's an account manager underneath them. Soon there will be a head of growth leads. Then there will be a department overseeing the pods. Then there will be a senior management team overseeing them. And we'll build up this typical corporate hierarchy, and basically to imply upon them, or to impress upon them, that the longer you stick with me, the harder we work together, the more value we together as a team can bring, the higher the propensity for you to be at the top. And super honestly, happy to say some of those folks who started with me in the early days stayed with me all the way through and saw pretty pretty decent cash windfall because I included them on part of the exit there. And so,
did they have options, or was it just a gift?
No, this was part of the cat. This is part of the flow of funds. Yeah, so this was a, they didn't know it was coming. This was mainly like a, I told you I would take care of you type of thing, right? And I made it good on my word. And so, kind of went to bat for them in order to get the equivalent of options, if you will, in the parent company who ended up building us. But at the same time, out of at least the cash component of what I took, there was a whole piece carved out there for them, right? Some of my senior leadership. So, yeah, you know, it's just constantly trying to paint the vision for folks and make sure that they're staying aligned with that, typical CEO things. But at the same time, finding ways to stay profitable, but arbitrage, I would say, lesser expensive talent that is equally as talented, if you want to call it that.
So I'm going into to LinkedIn and I'm searching Columbia, Boston University, marketing, like those three words. And I'm trying to find who comes up. Is that how you're finding these people?
No. So I built relationships in country, right? So as an example, like in Colombia, they have a great organization, Pro Colombia. They also have one out of Medellin called Ruta N. And these are effectively arms. They're non-for-profit, I don't believe, but they're basically arms of the government to try to encourage and spur international investment, exposure of local talent, international companies. So just classic stuff. I spent a lot of time on the ground in those countries and started to meet folks and hear about it. I'm located here in Miami, so obviously they have a heavy presence here. And then as I just met people and built relationships, I started getting introductions and then frankly capitalized on the existing introductions. So my very first developer I ever hired, he was a tremendous developer. And, you know, when we started to grow and I was like, we need a second developer. He's like, I can get one, no problem. I was like, we need a designer. He was like, one of my best friends is an award-winning designer. He's still our head of design today, right? 5 years later. So, you know, just using my existing workforce to be introduced to other folks, right? That classic model also did it. And then, you know, just honestly really tried to do my best to take care of the employees the absolute best that I could all the time. You know, I mean,
how did you structure it legally? Like, were they employees of NROC or subcontractors? How did you structure legally?
Yeah, great question. So at first we just did international, right? Which is, hey, look, I can't give you a proper contract in country, but I can give you a international contractor payment. And then you got to handle all of your own taxes and securities and benefits, et cetera, internally. And I just naturally paid them commensurate with that. So they'd have a higher payment. After not very long, we ended up effectively incorporating in some of these countries in order to legally provide that, which, by the way, turned out to be a whole profit center. So this is kind of Amazon-esque, not to get ahead of my skis on this question, but we ended up going about a year and a half after that. And I started to notice clients were asking me, they'd say things like, hey, love your team. Everything's great. I'm curious, how do I get a designer like yours? I know they're based out of Bogota or Medellin or Cartagena or whatever. I'd love to do it. I'd assume you're paying less than US rate. And I'd say, yes, I am, of course. And then when they heard about it, they were like, please help me find someone. I need an executive assistant. I need an account manager. I need a designer, a developer, whatever. And so I basically just said, well, I've got a constant influx of leads coming in. If we find somebody that's not a good fit for us, but might be good for you, I can put them on my payroll, give them my benefits package, and then just bill you a fee. And that turned out to be what was a cost center for us, turned out to be a profit center for us. So we were able to monetize. Jeez. Yeah, that too, which turned out to be a whole ancillary business model that, by the way, did get wrapped up in our acquisition too. So that worked out really well. But yeah.
I find that just incredibly fascinating. And again, very unusual in a services business that the founder would be able to retain 100% of the equity. So walk me through how big did you get this company? So and if I'm getting this, the numbers right, 2016, 2017, 2000, you're kind of a hired gun, lone wolf. You make the decision. There's a lot of demand here in 2019. You start to hire people. Like, how big did you get before you decided to sell?
Yeah. So my first hire was like literally January 2nd, 2019. So it was exactly at the beginning of the year. And we ended up exiting selling on December 4th, 2023. So it was almost to the month. 5 years, right? So in that time period, we were able to scale up to our run rate was about just a bit over 7 million in revenue. And when you looked at our total, run rate on an annualized basis, our trailing 12 months on that would have been closer to 5 million, right? Just because obviously we were growing so much actually right there at the end before we sold. And we kept really, really strong profit margins there. So we were between 2 and 3 million in EBITDA by the time we exited. So obviously we were anywhere on a given year between 40% and 50%+ on a margin, which was tremendous. And, you know, obviously we used a lot of that to reinvest right back into the business and give different bonus structures and to open up new offices and invest in new technologies and tools internally to try to service the clients. But yeah, it was a great cash flow positive business from basically day one. And so, yeah.
Were you tempted just to pocket the cash, slow down and just take the $2 million and put it in your jeans every year?
That was the plan. That was literally exactly the plan. I wasn't trying to sell. That wasn't the intention. Honestly, we were just cruising along to give you the actual story, what literally happened here. But we were humming along and we had a great 2022, 2023, started a little slow, but we were really starting to pick up kind of like right around this time, the very end of Q1 in 2023. I had just planned out like this whole new investment structure on things I wanted to go into this new software model I wanted to build for the company. And I started thinking about like, oh, maybe we'll start living overseas. We could do all these things because there's so much cash flow with the business. And then at the time, I used a fractional CFO, right? We weren't, in my opinion, as sophisticated or complex of enough of a business to require a full-time CFO. So we had a part-time CFO who coincidentally split his other time with a paid media agency, which is in the world of e-com is we call it pre-click, right? So they're focusing on, you know, Instagram ads, Meta ads, Facebook ads, you know, Google search, et cetera. So they're pre-click, we're post-click, we're serving the same types of clients. Their CEO flew down to Miami and we had like a 4-hour lunch together one day. And he basically, outside of getting into the, let's talk about if we have a good cultural fit, he had proposed something very interesting to me, which is he's like, look, you may not be looking to sell, but understand the economics of multiples and risk premiums that are inversely related here. And so I basically got a little masterclass there on understanding how, even though we're a $2 million EBITDA business and they're a $2 million EBITDAs, you know, at $2 million EBITDA, you're going to get maybe a 5, a 6. If you're really attractive, maybe a 7, right? I think that's
times.
Yeah, times EBITDA in terms of your valuation. So his whole model was like, look, we have a model here where we can be 2 + 2 = 6. And what I mean by that is your two, my two together as one company. If we can hit 5, we're immediately an 8. That was effectively how he pitched me. And so effectively, your 50% is worth more than your 100%, if that makes sense. So that's when I started to really think about, okay, maybe there is an interesting scalable model here. And the original plan was to come together as a unit, get to that point, try to get some private equity backing, and then just start to gobble up other smaller agencies and then turn this into a large exit at some point. In that process, Todd, who introduced us, who was the banker who represented me, came into the fold and we started chit-chatting. And basically the gentleman who had connected us, who was the founder of the former agency, connected me with Todd so I could learn a little bit more about how risk premiums worked, how private equity valued companies, what they would like, what they would not like. So no kidding, in our first call, as I was giving him kind of my spiel and very much like I shared with you today about what NRUC is, he kind of interrupted me partway through and was like, I got to tell you, I have a bunch of different agencies, large ones out there. You're exactly what they're looking for in their acquisition prospectus. For your education only, would you be okay if I just circulated some of your materials with them? And so I said, sure, why not? Can't hurt. No kidding. The next morning, he texted me and he said, all three want to talk, quote, ASAP. And whether that was exactly accurate or not, I would give him the benefit of the doubt. I think it probably was given how it went. But I was like, all right, we'll see if this is legit. So I started having these calls. And sure enough, I had these really fascinating calls with these large agency owners. You know, they're doing 30 million in revenue, 80 million, 100 million, 200 million in revenue. And most of them said the same thing. We have not been able to get our conversion rate optimization division to fly. We could not get it. You guys are 100 and whatever clients. You're a pretty substantial team. Would you ever consider an offer? I didn't really answer those questions. I kind of dodged it. And I talked to Todd and he told me something very wise, which was he said, you're going to get an MBA in how this works. And most importantly, understanding where your business is weak and what you need to work on to get better enterprise value. And that sold me. And I said, you know what? Worst case scenario, I engage him. It's a relatively low amount of money. I'm going to get all sorts of understanding from the market as to what they like and what they don't like. And I'm going to take it back and go work. And then long story short, the offers started to come in and I had had a number in mind that I thought the company was worth and basically had thresholds above that, that I would take this very seriously if they came in higher. And one of them came in a little higher. One of them came in way higher than I thought. And so that's when things really started to get real. And
What was your number?
Say again.
What was your number?
Yeah. So again, as mentioned, 2 to 3 million EBITDA business. Typically, you're probably looking at like a 5 or a, I mean, there's loads of variables that change. Don't get me wrong, but I was assuming I'd be a 5 or a 6. If someone really liked us, maybe a 7. We came in multiple turns ahead of that. Like, put it this way, ahead of what I even thought we'd be at 5 million. So we got, and this is probably, I don't think there's any data to back this up out there, but from all the conversations I've had, which are probably 50, 60 conversations with agency owners, I think we probably got the highest multiple of any agency that size that I've ever heard of, right? So, and it was on top of the valuation, the way the deal was structured was very attractive to what I wanted to do. It was just a no-brainer, right? It really was. It was a no-brainer offer. I loved the group that was proposing it. The founder and I just immediately hit it off. We were talking about golf all the time. We had a lot of synergies there, you know? And yeah, we just really hit it off. So culturally, I thought it'd be a good fit. The number was more than right. And I went for it.
And how did they structure the offer? Like, you know, did they ask you to roll some equity or earn out or what kind of elements?
Yeah. What was fascinating about them is, you know, I'm in my mid 30s. So my thing was the long game here. I didn't want to cash out. I wanted to go for the longer play. And so very, I want to say almost responsibly and professionally, they kind of asked me in a way to be like, what are you looking for? What's the best case scenario for you? I mean, it was a wonderful process. Really, it was. I know a lot of people talk about they had difficult processes in an acquisition. This was a wonderful process. And they really listened to me and wanted to hear what I wanted. Then they put the LOI together after that. So my answer was, I want to keep as much equity, roll for as much equity as I can. I'd like to take enough cash off the table to change some things in my life. But again, as you had referenced before, we were a high profit agency, like things were going really well, you know, it's like, so we didn't need this big cash influx or any or windfall, but I wanted enough chips off the table to basically make a, you know, make a change in the lifestyle and such. And we did, but I wanted to roll forward as much equity as I possibly could. And they met me there. So we roll forward a very substantial chunk in equity, right? I mean, it's, I don't know to what degree I can share specific percentages, but basically half, right, is equity, right? Mm. So yeah, a little higher than normal.
So you took almost half of your proceeds of the value. So let me see if I get this straight. Ordinary circumstances, you might get 5x EBITDA, 6, 7 if things are going amazing. And you did multiple turns better than that. So it's a big nut.
Yeah, correct.
It's a great valuation. And you took half of that and put it in your jeans. The other half, you rolled and became a shareholder. And I'd just be curious to know, are you now a shareholder in your division or a shareholder in the mothership, so to speak, the acquirer of your company?
The latter. So yeah, very much the latter. So kind of in that common share structure, right? The same type of share structure that the private equity firm principals have, that the original owners do, the former acquisition targets had. So yeah, very, very much. And that was important to me. And they were very deliberate on that to make sure our incentives were aligned. Right. So yeah, now I'm effectively part of a 700 person team and focused on the real end goal now, which is to exit again, right, in the next 3 to 5 years or so, with at this time, many business partners, if you will, right, who are other folks on the equity stack there. And then a huge team behind us that we want everybody to win with. So yeah, we just basically the same objective all over again now, just at a larger scale and with a lot more firepower behind us.
And the large company that ultimately acquired you is called Power Digital.
Yep, correct. Right? Yeah. Power Digital, which is basically one of the more recognized agencies that's been around for the last 10, 12 years or so. And as they've grown, they've scaled to be a powerhouse, obviously, in the paid media side, all the pre-click acquisition, but strategically and quite effectively acquired a lot of businesses along the way. And they had actually, you can read up all about this too, about them. They had a really fascinating exit too, where they had sold to private equity. I believe it was in 2019. And then in 2022, they sold again for a huge return. I mean, like industry bent, like, you know, set a new benchmark for the industry type of return. It was really fascinating. And now we're trying to do it again and yeah, on our way to it. So,
how did you do reverse due diligence on Power Digital? You know, you go from, in your own admission, being like, don't play nice in the sandbox, yeah, entrepreneur.
Yeah.
You know, I've seen that before.
Yeah. Yeah.
To being a minority shareholder in a giant company.
Yeah.
How did you evaluate them as a potential shareholder of their share?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. A couple of things. One is, and probably the most important thing, and I do want to share this story because this is hopefully how anyone who's in, looking to exit will look at their buyer, which is, and it's, it kind of goes to very basic principles, which is like, look at the effort that they put in. As an example, I had my first call with Grayson, who's the original founder of Power Digital, and he's kind of the one who was courting me originally. And I had my first call with him in August or so, and we talked business, and we talked a little bit about golf, we talked about traveling. And he asked, he's like, can I follow up with you? Can, you know, let's, here's my number, text me, et cetera. First off, the only one to do that of all the targets, he was the only one to say, let's stay in touch. Let's just chat. Everyone's, you know, he texts me on a Sunday, be like, did you golf this week? I'd be like, yeah, I did. How'd you shoot? Da-da-da-da. You know, we had like, we built a friendship, you know what I mean? Like legitimately. And it wasn't forced. It wasn't strategic. He just like genuinely was interested. He was also asking me for strategies. You know, have you ever run into this with a client? What do you think? We've tried doing that. How's this going for you? Here's how we solve that. So beyond just becoming business partners, like we were strategically related at that point to give each other and one another advice. On top of that, the private equity firm CourtSquare behind Power Digital, when they presented the LOI as an example, and this was really important for me. The other groups just emailed it over. They emailed it to Todd. Todd got on and explained it to me. CourtSquare and Power didn't want to do that. They got an hour, I think it was an hour, hour and a half block of my time, got on a video call and spent the entire time selling me on why they were a good fit, why our strategic visions aligned, why this was a good offer. And also more importantly, explaining all of the different elements, right? So when you start getting into like PIUs, right? Profit interest, I didn't know what that was. I had never heard of that initialism before. They spent all the time they needed and they walked me through it and explained it. And then they went through three or four different scenarios. If we do really well, knock it out of the park together, here's what that looks like realistically. And then every layer below that, right? And the other groups, no one bothered to do any of that, right? And so the level of effort there was evident from day one. So I really wanted to emphasize that because it made me comfortable. And I was like, I would love to work with these people. Just like they're like me. They're just over delivering across the board. On top of that, given that they were a big agency and we run in the same space, I had some clients who worked with them. So I just went right to them. How is it? And most importantly, what's the culture like, right? And more as I heard and talked about it, it sounded super similar to us. Really rapid fire communication, really aggressive leadership team, super hungry leadership, very data driven, very data centric, very much a lateral style management where it's not any one person who's pulling the hierarchy card. There's a lot of CEO will listen to this account director and this account director will listen to this account manager, which I loved, kind of this more of like, just workplace that I was more accustomed to that I tried to build with Enroc. So that's what I did. I audited a little on my own and I just paid attention to the little details on, you know, how they cared. The other groups, frankly, just kind of felt like we were a good target and they wanted to gobble us up and then move on to the next thing a little, right? We had some nice conversations, but that was pretty much it. None of the other founders, CEOs really spent that much time getting to know me. Grayson spent a lot of time, right? He was like, hey, regardless of whatever happens here, dude, we got to play golf. He's like, come out here. We'll go play there. I'll be out in Florida. And, you know, and I was like, this is great. Like, I really enjoy. And frankly, it's still like that. I'm actually going out to California next week. We're going to go play Torrey Pines at the next weekend together. So like, it's exactly what it started with. It continued on to be. So again, it wasn't smoke and mirrors. It wasn't a marketing pitch. That's just really who they are, who he is, how CourtSquare is. And CourtSquare, frankly, is a private equity firm. I went in very cautiously because you hear about all these horror stories. It was a really enjoyable process. And
And did you get a sense of how much debt the private equity company has put on Power?
I do know. Yep, I do know. I can't share exactly what that is, but I do know. And again, I got an absolute master's in understanding larger scale, like the basically private equity, right? When they're getting into these larger scale acquisitions and how they use different financial instruments. And it was fascinating to learn, right? And I had to learn this during due diligence, in large part because our attorneys demanded learning it, but they were very open book and educated me along the way. So I could answer those questions more specifically. I don't just I could, but I can't.
That's fine.
But a very sophisticated model they've built there. Yeah.
This may fall in the same camp, but one of the downsides, I guess, of being a minority shareholder is you're kind of waiting around until the overall team decides that they want to sell it. They've got an offer they thought attractive. Unless you negotiate put options, were you able to, or did you try to get put options, the ability to sell your shares that you rolled at a certain time for a certain price? Are you all in with the new group?
Yeah, I didn't. I'm all in with the new group. My vision is their vision. We're 100% aligned. And frankly, I kind of wanted it that way and they wanted it that way, right? I mean, again, I had no exit in mind. I wasn't looking to sunset again in my mid 30s. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Just was looking more for the long haul here. And they presented a very attractive offer in other stipulations in the deal, in addition to just like the actual valuation, that made that route even more incentivizing for me. So once again, it was just like all visions were aligned on this one, right? We all kind of wanted the same thing and we all met each other where we said we would.
Yeah, well, I'm super happy for you. I'm thrilled that it's worked out. Of course, we were put in touch with Todd and he's a great guy who knows the stuff for sure. So I'd love to ask you some quick lightning round of questions before I let you go. Sure. Are you up for that?
Yeah, please.
Awesome. Okay. You talked to lots of different acquirers. Sounds like they were courting you, not the other way around. But was there ever one who tried to play a kind of slimy trick on you or use your relative naivete about the process of selling a company to kind of put one over on you?
I thankfully and truthfully can say no. I didn't. I read about a lot of those. I didn't experience it. I can say one of the groups accused the group who bought me of doing that when they heard about the offer, because they were like, they're just clearing the room. They're just trying to get everybody out. There's no way they're going to actually pay them that. They did. So they were legit. But no, but I have heard a lot of those stories. If I can touch on that really quick, because I think there's an interesting point there. And again, look, this is my first meaningfully, big exit, right? When you're getting, deep into the eight figures kind of thing, like a really sizable life-changing exit. It's also the first time I've ever dealt with private equity on this front. So take this for what it's worth. I've had one experience. But what I found in the process at almost every turn where something felt like that doesn't seem fair, or why is this happening, or why are you asking for that, or why are you cutting me down there? It was pretty much 100% because of my ignorance to how this works, right? So as an example, understanding networking capital adjustments. That was a real learning lesson for me. And at first glance, I'm like, what do you mean? Like, there were some elements there where something, we had to cut down on a couple different things, et cetera, kind of towards the tail end. And then when they walked me through and explained it, it's exactly right. It's perfect by the textbook, exactly accurate in what they were asking for. I just didn't understand it. And as I understood it, I became more comfortable with it. So when you hear about some of these horror stories, basically they say, don't always assume to whomever's listening to this that, oh, it's because the private equity firm was trying to screw them over. Yes, those things I'm sure happen quite a bit. But in a lot of cases, you got to give the benefit of the doubt of like, maybe it was because the founder just wasn't that knowledgeable in how this works. And that is what it is. You got to get educated on these things.
Could you describe a networking capital adjustment
for
layman's terms if somebody doesn't know that
term? Yeah, sure. I mean, in layman's terms, it's effectively like the actual liquidity and capital that the business is going to need to sustain itself and then also to continue to sustain itself based on the current AR, the current AP, and then on the projection of what's inbound for acquisition, hires, expense schedules, et cetera. So here's the interesting thing. We were growing really fast. So when you're growing really fast, what are the pros to that? Better valuations, better multiples, better incentive, I don't know, all this other things. But what's a potential negative to it? Your networking capital requirement is going to go up. And not only is it going to go up, you can't realistically use a 12-month average or a 6-month average. Because if you're growing at 10% month over month, 12 months ago, it's like a completely different company. It makes no financial sense to use that. So when you use, say, a 3-month average and you're growing like this, the required capital to keep in the business is probably a lot higher than you think. And that cash reserve you set up, which I had, may not be enough, in which case they're going to deduct you and ding you on that. And then at first you're like, I don't get it. I have cash. I've never had a cash issue. It seems fine. But that's how the math works. You're growing this fast. You've got to continuously increase that. So With that all being said, you've got to understand how these networking capital schedules work and then be real with yourself. Do you actually have those cash reserves in a business? Most companies probably don't. Smaller, lesser sophisticated companies probably don't. So that's an example of how networking capital adjustment came in and what it is on an elementary basis.
Thank you very much for that layperson's description. I've often heard the working capital calculation is the second most important number on a term sheet. You know, of course, the headline price is what everybody zeroes in on, but how they're going to deal with working capital is another one you want to make sure. Great point. What was the biggest mistake you made personally in the process of selling your company? Again, it sounds like a dreamlike sale, but was there one thing that, if I had a do-over, I had a mulligan, use a golf expression, I'd love to maybe do that differently.
I don't know. Honestly, this may sound arrogant to say, but I can't think. I mean, this was awesome. This went so well, you know. I mean, I don't want to say I couldn't have asked for a better offer. I couldn't have asked for a better partner. I couldn't have asked for better education on it. Due diligence was really hard, but that's par for the course, not to keep using golf analogies, but like that is it. You know what I mean? So you can't really change anything about that. I didn't go hunting for it. They kind of came to me. It happened super naturally. I can't really think of like one thing I regret or one thing I would have necessarily done differently. I can tell you a couple of things that I'm super glad I did do, which is, and I would recommend this to everybody, is be wildly transparent from the beginning. Like outrageously transparent. If you had so much as a mumbling of a ex-employee who was unhappy or a client who said, hey, you know, I didn't get what I wanted and I want my money back, whatever, even if it was 2 years ago, state it, write it down, put it in your disclosure schedules, talk about it up front, state everything personally, professionally, whatever, because they will find it, I promise you. And no degree of smoke and mirror tactic that you do will create a result where they don't figure it out. And you're going to put yourself in a way worse position if they do figure out, because now there's going to be elements of, well, were you dishonest with us, et cetera? Were you manipulative about the truth? So I've found a lot of companies are like, hey, I think if I can move this on my balance sheet or if I can state this, it's like, don't. Just be really wildly transparent. And you might even get a benefit from that. And then the other thing is I was extremely organized before this happened, just because being a data guy, I'm kind of OCD with it. I track every metric in the business, right? And boy, was I glad I did that, because they sent me, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of line item questions and due diligence from accounting, legal, insurance, et cetera. And a lot of them, I had reports already built on how I'd measure these things. So I had used Loom videos and I went through, I remember they sent me my due diligence list, the first one on a Friday, and I was flying back from Colombia. And so from Friday all the way till Sunday night, I did not leave the office and put, I don't know, a couple dozen videos together, all these new reports, and basically explained the business on an intimate level in every report I had. And the private equity firm was like, this probably saved us like a month, like literally this one bit right here. So get prepared now if you're going to do it, right? If anyone's listening to this and you're interested in that. And when I say get prepared, I mean have a census, as an example, of every employee and every contractor you've ever hired, all their information, when you hired them, what the role was, when they left, if they left, what the different salaries were throughout it, why they left. And then if there's any negativity there from the beginning of you started your company till now. That may sound obvious. Hardly any business measure that or record those things, right? Big ones do. Small ones don't. So just be hyper organized, know every detail, every question, because they're going to come at you with, I mean, an absolute magnifying glass, and you don't want to be caught in an awkward position.
Well put. What was the emotional high that you experienced just through this process? Can you describe the moment where you were, what you were doing? What was the high?
Yeah. The highs I could say was kind of when I got that first, I'll never forget it, when I got the LOI. Just because the number, I was like, really? You think, like, this is amazing. I didn't, you know, I obviously thought we were worth a lot, but it validated that for me, right? It was a very, because, you know, you never really know. I obviously am impartial to the business, but it validated that the marketplace thought we were as valuable as I thought we were. And that was a really big deal for me. The other highs for me was when I was able to negotiate ongoing options, the kind of equivalent of, if you will, for some of my leadership team. Mm-hmm. That was a big deal. Being able to give out the cash bonuses, my team, that was a moment I won't forget, just their reaction because they didn't know it was coming. That was very, and again, these are pretty substantial amounts. And then after it closed, frankly, it's pretty brutal at the end. It doesn't really hit you like when it closed. And it's this very odd anticlimactic process where it's like, you go through this brutal due diligence and the lawyers are going at each other and this and that. And it's like 1 a.m. on a Friday night and everyone's on the call. And then you finally get to close and it's this like 5 minute thing. And it's reminiscent of like a marriage. There's like this intermediary from the bank who's like, so-and-so from the private equity, do you agree to this? Da-da-da. Yes, we do. Net, you know, from Endrock, do you agree to this? Yes, I do. Okay, congrats, everybody. Have a good night. You know, it's closed. And you're like, okay, that's it. Like, and that's all. And we just hang up, right? So it's very anticlimactic. But about 3 days after that, it really started to hit. And that was a pretty cool high that I rode for a while. But yeah, it was obviously, you know, another one I want to say there is the power team did a tremendous job about starting the integration early. So I went out to San Diego, their headquarters, a good five, six weeks before we closed and started working on integration. Here's everyone on my team. Here's their personality. Here's their strengths. Here's their weaknesses. We actually started even working on some of their clients, which we just created a little referral style. They basically just referred some of those clients over to us to watch how we operated with them, right? So we really started that process early. That was a lot of fun because then it cemented for me, like, this is definitely a team I want to work with and be associated with.
As you prepared to exit, it sounds like you were well represented by Todd, but was there something that you consumed that you could point our listeners to that helped you get ready to exit?
Yeah. I didn't have... So a couple things there, because it kind of came out of nowhere, remember, because like these conversations started and the LOI hit 3 weeks later and I went from not even really interested in selling to, oh my God, I'm going to sell just like that. I can say the attorneys that I used Greenberg Traurig, right? And they were tremendous. Heiza Vargas was kind of the primary who led it for me. She's based out of the Miami office here. She really was patient with me and took a lot of time to explain because she's on the buy side and sell side. So she took a lot of time to explain. This is how this goes. This is what you can expect. Here's the things we're going to look out for. When this happens, don't be concerned. And she was a tremendous asset. So your legal team is likely going to be a good asset for you. Todd was the single biggest asset for me, right? Todd walked me through the whole thing hand in hand. We talked every day, multiple days for like 4 months, right? And he was tremendous. Did everything he said he was going to do. So that was huge. And then I just talked to other agency owners who had exited prior. And then lastly would be, frankly, the buyer, dare I say. I mean, Grayson was a huge advocate for me, right? I mean, I would talk to him when I didn't understand things and we'd chat about it. The folks from CourtSquare, his name is Brian Schmidt and Ed Crotty were the two who were kind of leading the deal. We were on I could call him anytime. I don't think he ever missed a single phone call of mine. And he'd be like, what's on your mind? Let's talk about it. Like, does this not make sense? And it wasn't always just like, hey, Ned, you're wrong. This is how it goes. Sometimes he's like, you know what? You're right. I can see why that doesn't make sense. Let me get back to you. It was a very collaborative process. So I didn't have any traditional resources that I was spending time with that got me prepared for this. There are loads of them out there, like your podcast as an example. But I didn't have much prep going into it. And thankfully, I had a great acquirer who was patient with me. I had a great legal team. I had great banking representation from Todd. And then just other folks who had kind of seen the success of Endrock and were rooting for me, who gave me bits of advice as well along the way.
Last question. Would you buy yourself as a trophy?
So a couple things. So one thing that was cool is in addition to the deal monument that we got, Grayson and the CEO of Power, Jeff, are big golfers too. So they got me a Scotty Cameron putter with our company names engraved on it. That was a really cool memento, right? And then I bought myself I'm a car guy, so I got myself another car.
What'd you get?
Yeah, I got a Ferrari. So I'd had my eyes on an 812 for a while, kind of the big, you know, last of a dying breed, the naturally aspirated V12. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. So that was on my list for a long time as a congratulations to myself. So yeah.
I'm a huge believer in having a physical monument to remember an amazing achievement.
So yeah, it was great.
For you. Hey, if people want to reach out to you and say hi on social, is LinkedIn the best place? Or are you Instagram? Where's best?
Yeah, LinkedIn's going to be the best spot for sure. Absolutely, just reach out on LinkedIn. I'm more than happy to chat with folks, et cetera, and happy to give value wherever I can. And of course, we're always trying to, most importantly, add value to potential clients, right? So any businesses out there that are looking for kind of the cutting edge experimentation and conversion optimization and growth for revenue post-click, we're definitely the group to chat with.
I love that pre-click, post-click. And we'll put all that in the show notes at builttosell.com. Ned, thanks for doing this.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
And there you have it for today's episode between John and Ned. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then be sure to hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening to today's show. And if you want to help support this podcast, I'd encourage you to share this episode out with a friend or colleague. For show notes, including links to everything referenced in today's episode, including definitions for some of the more technical terms used, be sure to visit Ned's episode page, which you'll be able to find over at builttosell.com. Also, again, if you want to nominate someone to be a guest right here on Built to Sell Radio, just visit builttosell.com/nominate, where there you're going to have a chance to nominate yourself or someone else to be a guest right here on the show with John. Special thanks to Dennis Labataglia for handling today's audio engineering, and thank you to our community of certified value builders who help us bring our message to you. Our advisors are experts in helping you build the value of your company. To get in touch with an advisor or learn how to become one yourself, visit valuebuilder.com. I'm Colin Morgan, and I look forward to talking to you again next week.